Hello and welcome to Travels Through Time. In each episode of this podcast, we invite a special guest to take us on a tailored tour of the past. Travels Through Time is brought to you in partnership with History Today, Britain's best-loved serious history magazine. You can read articles relating to this podcast and more about our guests at historytoday.com/travels. There is also a special subscription offer for Travels Through Time listeners. 3 issues for just £1 each. Hello, my name is Peter Moore and welcome to Travels Through Time. I want to start by saying thank you to all of you who listened to our last episode on D-Day. It was one of our most popular episodes yet, so thank you for that. But today we're going to be leaving 20th century Europe behind and we're going to be heading for 19th century Japan and to one of the most significant moments in that island's history. Today's guest is the writer and cultural historian Leslie Downer. The great subject of Leslie's writing life, and indeed her great passion, is Japan. She first went to the country in 1978, and she's been living there or visiting ever since. She spent 6 months living among the geisha for her book Geisha, The Secret History of a Vanishing World, and her book On the Narrow Road to the Deep North was shortlisted for the Thomas Cook Travel Book of the Year Award. More recently, Leslie has turned to fiction with her Shogun Quartet of novels. These chart the most dramatic period in Japanese history. That's the mid-19th century world, a time of civil war and of encounter with the West. I met with Leslie the other day in Notting Hill. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Welcome to Travels Through Time, Leslie.
Thank you.
Okay, so let's start off with a general question, but one which is really important for me to ask. What is it that drew you towards Japanese history or Japan in general in the first place?
Well, I arrived in Japan when I was pretty young for no particular reason, settled in, spent about 2 years living there and just got very, very caught up in all aspects of Japanese culture. And one of the first things I did was read the Penguin Anthology of Japanese Literature from cover to cover, from sort of the tale of Genji up to modern day literature, and was entirely gripped by Japanese literature. And then as I started travelling, I started to discover bits and pieces about Japanese history.
Was it an easy culture to... Did you have a moment where you thought you got it, or was it a culture that you had to find your way into slowly, degree by degree?
It's very famously a culture that you never, ever feel that you've got. Okay. You never feel you've got it. To me, knowing the history makes a big difference. Mm. Knowing the language makes a big difference. I'd like to spend as much time as I can with Japanese, not with foreigners, when I'm in Japan. And the language, the body language and so on, help you to get inside the culture, I think.
And of course, you learnt Japanese, the language as well, that's right, yeah?
I was living in a city in which there were no other Westerners whatsoever. So it was a sink or swim situation. So either I could have conversations along the lines of, why do you not drink coffee? All foreigners drink coffee. Why do you not eat meat? All foreigners eat meat, which was really boring. So I therefore wanted to learn Japanese as soon as I possibly could in order to take control of the conversation and have sensible conversations about all sorts of things.
Okay, and you've identified this period that we're going to be talking about today as a really dramatic and consequential time in Japanese history. The most dramatic, you might say, and we're going to be talking about the year 1853. At the moment. Before we dive into our time machine, and I must say we're in a very time machine-ish kind of environment today in a dark studio in Notting Hill, but before we do that, tell us really just a bit of the cultural and historical background to the mid-19th century. What's going on in Japan at that time?
Japan had been closed completely to the West for 250 years. It closed itself off to all Western entry around 1625 and remained closed thereafter. The only Westerners that were allowed to enter were the Dutch. 20 Dutch merchants lived there in an artificial island shaped like a fan off Nagasaki, and only those merchants could live there. They couldn't bring their wives. And once a year, a Dutch ship came for trading, and there were Japanese on the dock to get all the information about the West that they possibly could from this Dutch ship. So Japan was closed to all Western access. Chinese and Koreans could still come and go. But it was completely banned by law to go abroad. If you did happen to be shipwrecked, you wouldn't go back to Japan because you'd be executed if you did. So there was was a kind of closure of Japan to the outside world. But meanwhile, within Japan, the most stupendous culture was developing, a very, very rich culture, not influenced by Western culture.
Okay, so this is a really fascinating idea of a almost like a hermit kingdom, isn't it? Which is hermetically sealed away throughout what we think of in historical terms in the West, at least, as the great era of exploration, which starts maybe with Columbus and goes through
the great era of being colonised.
The great era of being colonised.
Which Japan missed out on. It did very, very well.
Yeah, exactly. And then at the same time, you have got this very, very tiny element of it with the one Dutch ship. It's like a fine thread, isn't it, connecting Japanese society to this greater historical project which is going on.
There's a pretty great historical project going on in Japan. Mm. But the Japanese were extremely well aware of the West. They had what they called schools of Dutch learning. Books of anatomy came in, guns came in, all sorts of things came in on that one Dutch ship. Astrolabes came in, globes came in. They knew what we were up to. We didn't know what they were up to.
Okay.
We were ignorant, they were not. Any Japanese that wanted to know more about Western culture would learn Dutch. So there were quite a few Dutch speakers in Japan.
Okay, what was the formation of Japanese society at this time? Was it a feudal system or what? How would you describe it and characterise it for us?
So you have the emperor who lives in his palace and is poor and has no power and is a kind of pope figure who conducts religious ceremonies to keep Japan safe and happy. And you have the shogun who lives in his palace in Edo, which we now call Tokyo. And he is, over the centuries, becoming more and more like the queen. So he too doesn't have that much power. And then there's a kind of board of governors, like, almost like a parliament, that rule the show. And there's also a very rigid social structure with the ruling class at the very top, the samurai, who are the military class, and wear two swords to mark their status under them. Then you have the artisans, you have the farmers, and right at the bottom you have the merchants, who are the bottom because they soil their hands with money. But they are the bottom of the social pecking order, but they're also getting richer and richer.
Mm.
That's the social system.
So you say in your novel, I was just reading, that Japan has been at peace for close on 250 years, and that it's made up of some 260 princedoms, which each has its own local clan lord, almost, with a degree of autonomy, but they are working harmoniously as a whole as well, which is really interesting. So I think that sets the scene, really. Let's imagine that world and see where we can go within it. So let's go to our first scene. It's Friday, July the 8th. We're in Edo Bay, and it's 1853. Probably the first question I should ask you is, what does Edo Bay look like?
I've actually sailed into Edo Bay myself. And on each side you have these kind of headlands, which probably have not changed a lot since then, kind of wooded. You can't see what is deep inside. So there is a little town called Uraga at the mouth of the bay. And beyond that, the bay winds around. There are little inlets. And at the far end, maybe 25 miles down the way, which is 40 kilometres, is the city of Edo, which is one of the biggest cities in the world. It probably is the biggest city in the world.
At this point.
Yes, yes. And very, very advanced culture. But you don't know that in your ship. You can see the cliffs on each side and you're sailing through quite a narrow path. Also, all Western ships could only go to Nagasaki. They were not permitted to go to anywhere else. Mm-hmm. So they were breaking Japanese law by going to Edo Bay.
Okay, so what's happening on this Friday in July then, which makes it notable for us to go and visit on this occasion?
Okay, so I think of it as being like aliens invade. If you were Japanese, it was like spaceships landing. So if you think of the film Independence Day,
okay,
which has showed these mammoth spaceships that were bigger than any spaceship could feasibly ever be. If you were a Japanese fisherman and you are out fishing at the mouth of Edo Bay and you see coming towards you four ships which are simply bigger than it's humanly possible for any ship to be. Also, it is a windless day, so you can't go out because your sails aren't really operating. And these ships are moving, which is very extraordinary because it's a windless day and they have smoke coming out of them, like dragons perhaps. So this was like the most shattering thing that could possibly happen. It was like Martians invade. You have thousands of little ships.
Yeah.
So the bay is full of thousands of Japanese junks who've all poured out to have a jolly good look at these massive ships. For most people in that country had never seen Dutch people. They'd never seen any Europeans of any sort. They'd only ever seen other Japanese. So here are these four ships with aliens on board. We don't know what they look like, probably horrible. We don't know what their intentions are, probably not good. And they're coming very aggressively straight towards you at speed. They were actually travelling at 9 knots.
Right, so there's a lot of perplexing detail here. You know, they've got the very familiar scene, everyone knows this, and the strange, what should we say, strange ships coming up, and no idea how they're being propelled forwards at all. Is this... As you paint it here, you talk about an alien invasion. Is it as unexpected as that? Or have there been moments in the recent past which have prepared them for this happening?
Depends who you mean by they. Mm. If it's the fishermen who are out fishing, it's completely unexpected. They then immediately sent warnings back to Edo, back to the government. The government were more aware that this might happen. They didn't want it to happen, but they thought it might happen. There had been other ships that had turned up over the last 40-odd years. There was an American called Commander Biddle who had turned up in the 1840s. He had actually got as far as these ships did, and he had allowed Japanese to get on board his ship. I think he got into a little boat himself, and a samurai pushed him over, which made him look very ridiculous in the eyes of the Japanese. So the Americans were very determined that this shouldn't happen again. There'd also been a British ship further back called the Phaeton, which had arrived in Nagasaki in 1808, flying the Dutch flag, trying to fool the Japanese. You can't fool the Japanese. When Napoleon had actually conquered Holland. So the British ship also tried to do that. The British also kidnapped some of the Dutch merchants when they arrived in their ship, the Phaeton. They also, I think, set that little Dutch colony on fire, but they got sent on their way.
So there's a few features of this which are different to what's happened before, though, aren't there? Because you were talking about it being the British, and I suppose at this point, as you mentioned earlier on, there were connections with China and Korea, and so there must have been some information passed about what the British had done in China over the past 20 years.
Not just information, the Japanese knew exactly all about the Opium War. They knew about the Opium War, they knew about the taking of Hong Kong, they knew about the devastation that the British were wreaking in China, and they didn't want that to happen to them.
So that's one of the interesting features here, that these are not British ships, are they?
There's a reason for that.
Okay.
It's the Crimean War. The Crimean War is about to start, which is the British and the French versus the Russians. And these are three major players, and they are out of circulation because they're fighting each other in the Crimea. Meanwhile, President Millard Fillmore, who's the president of America, has decided about 2 years earlier that he wants to open Japan, for want of a better word. And he commissions Commodore Perry to go off to Japan with two missions only. Commodore Perry's missions are, one, to allow American whaling ships to go into Japanese harbours and get coal, and number two, when Americans are cast away on Japanese shores, that they should be well treated. So that is his mission. That's it. The reason for the whole thing was whaling. The American whalers needed to put up somewhere and recall.
Yeah.
So whaling was huge. It was just after Moby Dick had been written. People were, you know, lighting their homes with whale oil in America. They were using whale oil in their machinery. Their corsets were stiffened with baleen, which is
and
a sort
presumably
of whale bone.
Among the whalers themselves, there would have been some contact between the Japanese and the American ships out in maybe the Pacific or something else.
Not before. Too much, because the Japanese would be in trouble.
But then the second feature, which is striking, so it's the Americans, it's not the British. We can talk in a moment about how much the Japanese would know about the Americans as well. It's the fact that we're just changing, in a technological sense, from the age of sail into the age of steam. And was this a completely new technology for the Japanese as far as they were concerned, or again something that they knew well about?
It depends again who you were. There was a daimyo who I write about in my novel called Shimazu Nariakira, who lived way down in the south of Japan. The daimyo were clan lords, 260 of them, ruling the 260 princedoms under the overall control of the shogun's government in Edo. But the further you were from Edo, the more you could get away with stuff. And Shimazu Nariakira, he spoke Dutch, he kept a diary in Dutch, he was very interested in all foreign goings-ons, and he had a secret shipbuilding yard where he was secretly building ships, steam. I'm sure he knew about steam. He also knew about ironclads. So people who were curious and informed would know about that sort of thing, yes.
Mm, but the fishermen maybe not so much.
Fishermen wouldn't know anything. They're just fishermen. They were busy being fishermen. except there was one fisherman called John Manjido was his later name, but He had been shipwrecked 10 years earlier, and he'd been rescued by an American, taken off to Boston, brought up, he was a kid, brought up speaking American as well as Japanese. And he was on board Perry's ship to be an interpreter. He was also scared because, you know, was he going to get his head cut off when he got back to Japan? Because anybody, any Japanese who'd been abroad was supposedly liable to be executed.
So this really connects us to a bigger history of encounter, doesn't it? Especially in the Pacific. And I know from writing about Cook's voyages a century earlier that you do get these incredibly vivid accounts of what people saw, and it's often been passed through oral histories, and there's descriptions of floating clouds and all the rest of it. Is there much historical documentation from the Japanese side of what happened on that day?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Goodness me, yes. The Japanese public was very well informed. There were lots of what were called kauroban, if you like, tabloid newspapers, which had drawings by woodblock print artists and lots of writing. Japanese were very curious about Western stuff. They were curious about the Dutch. And on the very first Japanese boats that came out to greet these four American ships, there were a whole lot of artists. And they were busy doing drawings to get back and get them published ASAP so that the Japanese public would know what was going on. So there are lots of drawings of ships. Also, like the Sun, the job of the kauroban was to get lots and lots of readers. So therefore, don't let the truth get in the way of a good story. So there's lots of drawings, lots of woodblock prints that show sort of ships with demon faces. Another thing is that Perry himself stayed hidden in his cabin, which is a whole different matter, because basically he was sure that the way to deal with the Japanese was on the basis of rank, and that he would only talk to a very high-ranking person. So he was not visibly seen for 7 or 8 days. But there were lots and lots of drawings of him all the same, looking like a tengu, which is a mythical creature with a massive nose. So there's these very ugly pictures of this ghastly red-faced sort of creature with a huge nose, which is Perry. So there were lots and lots of pictures of Perry circulating.
So there's so much to enjoy here in this scene, in an imaginative sense, I suppose, because as with any encounter, you have two sides, and on the one side we've spoken about these interpretations. There's some level of understanding of the technology that's going on politically, and Japan's not going to be able to exist in isolation forever. But then on the other side, you have Commodore Perry. So he's the American representative who's been sent on the special voyage, and there's four ships, is that right?
Yeah.
So how would you describe the ships in a European sense? If they might come across as strange floating alien spaceships to some, what would we describe them as? Would they just pretty average sailing ships, but motorised and with engines and stuff?
There were two steamships and there were two sloops.
Right.
The steamships were called the Susquehanna.
Yeah.
And it was 2,400 tons, which is 15 times heavier than any Japanese ship. These were sail and steam. The two steamships, they have lots of sails, beautiful ships. They also have a funnel in the middle with steam coming out, and they have engines below deck, and they also have paddle wheels.
So, well, we'll leave that scene there because it's a splendidly iconic one. And you can just imagine it, the whole great Bay of Tokyo as we think of it today, and this perplexing sight. So it's a really well-documented event.
Very well-documented.
Really. Well, we're going to follow the mission as it unfolds then, because we've gone from the Friday to the Monday, so now we're on the 12th of July 1853 and we're still in Edo Bay. Can you tell us what's happening next, please?
Okay, so the major figure who went out to intercede with the Americans is a man called Kayama Ezaimon, and he is a police magistrate. So he is one of the retainers of the mayor of Uraga, which is the little town where Perry's ships have arrived. So they're just at the mouth of Edo Bay, and he's going back and forth in his little ship trying to discuss with these Americans, why are they here, what do they want? What they want is they have a letter, they say, for the emperor. And this makes the Japanese laugh. What on earth has that got to do with the emperor, who's this kind of unknown bod who lives in Kyoto and has no power?
Yeah, because you told us earlier, so there's this division, isn't there, between the shogun and the emperor?
There's not a division. The emperor, actually, most people don't even know he exists.
Oh, right. So he's just a ceremonial presence.
He's a nothing.
Not really.
He lives sealed off inside his palace in Kyoto. Nobody ever sees him. He never comes out. Okay. Most people do not know there's an emperor. So when Perry says, we have a letter for the emperor, they go, what? What for?
I'm trying to think of what the equivalent was if someone turned up in Britain with a I don't know, a letter for some unknown figure that we'd forgotten long ago about. But this is the Japanese emperor in this case.
Yeah, who at that point is a nothing, a non-entity. Yeah. So Perry has said, we have letters and we will only deliver them. They are letters for the emperor. We have to deliver them to the person of the highest rank in Japan. So panic-stricken little boats go back and forth, Japanese boats, from the big ships up to Edo, back again. And in the government in Edo, is basically freaking out, for want of a better word. What on earth do we do about this? And there is already turmoil within Japan. There's a whole school of people who think we have to open up to the West because, look, it's inevitable. But the government and a lot of other people are saying, no, 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 we have to stay close. We've got to just drive these people away. But we can't drive them away because they have much bigger guns than we have.
Exactly.
And they've already actually blasted this little town in Uruga. They've already bashed down, I think, a few buildings just to show that they can do it with their cannonball. So that's going on. Poor old Kayama's going back and forth, and Perry has set an ultimatum of 3 days. And he says, if you don't arrange for a very high official to receive my letter, we will come on land and we will deliver the letter ourselves. And that means a troop of Americans marching on land with all their guns. So we don't want that to happen. So July the 12th is the deadline. That's the ultimatum. So the question is, what happens?
So, this is over the course of the weekend. So the Friday has seen the appearance of these ships and the Monday has seen this ultimatum come round. You hinted at something there, which is really intriguing for me. It seems to be that the Japanese have a very good intelligence about what's going on about things. What do the outside world, but in this case the Americans, know about the Japanese? Is a much less understanding of them?
Perry thinks he knows a great deal about them. He knows they're duplicitous. He knows that you can't trust them. They're heathens, which by definition means they're kind of stupid. They're natives. They're weak. They need to be pushed around. They need to be brought into the Western world. And there's also a lot more prejudice. So an example is that, this assumption that these people are kind of ignorant, and also that they're very dangerous. So, for example, the very first night that they arrive, Perry's men are up all night waiting for the Japanese to send fireships down. The Japanese are actually behaving quite nicely and behaving in quite a civilised way. The people being aggressive are the Americans.
Right. It's interesting because we're talking about not quite the high watermark for the Age of Empire. That comes maybe 50 years later on. But still, it's a time when people are going out into the world, from Europe in particular, from Britain, France. We know all about this. And they often have this way of classifying the people they come across, whether they be in Africa or the Americas or Asia. It seems like the Japanese exist outside of this easy classification system that the Europeans have in their head. They're a bit enigmatic, aren't they?
Because it was closed. So not that many people had been there. In fact, nobody had been there except these Dutch. And the Dutch did the best that they could. For example, the Dutch were not allowed to get hold of Japanese maps. And there was a guy who had got hold of Japanese maps. He was called Philip Sebald. The Japanese that gave him the maps got executed. And I think he got sent back to Holland in disgrace. Mm. So the Japanese were quite deliberately keeping the eyes of the world off Japan because they were so well aware of the history of colonisation. They knew about colonisation and they knew the huge danger that there was for their country.
So what is the moment when we get a representative going aboard one of Perry's ships? Do we know when that happened?
Oh, yes, we do. We know, yes. That was on the first day.
That was on the first day.
Yes, yes. Kayama Ezaimon had gone out there, and as I said to you, he was the police magistrate for the Bugyo, which is the mayor, if you like, of Uruga. And he's wearing his gorgeous kind of robes with embroidery of silver and gold. And he's standing in the little boat. And the guys on deck, we're back on July the 8th now, the guys on deck, the Americans, say, we will only let up somebody of the highest possible rank, even to come up onto this ship. Well, with Kayama is his mate, Nakajima, who is the same rank as he is. But who cares? So somehow the guys on the ship, there's a missionary called Samuel Wells Williams. He speaks a little Japanese and he says, this Nakajima, I think he's the governor of Uruga. He's not, but who cares? So he goes up on deck. So Nakajima gets to go on deck because the Americans think he's the governor. And he goes into Captain Buchanan's cabin. And he says, so what's going on? Why are you here? The Americans say, well, we have a letter to deliver.
Yeah, and you talk about the moment when the Americans produce a globe.
Ah, that comes a little bit later.
Comes a little bit later.
This is on the 12th, when the deadline has been reached, and Kayama comes back with the answer. they have an answer of how Perry is going to deliver his letter, who he's going to deliver it to. Mm. And this is a bit akin to what I just told you about Nakajima. There is a bloke called Toda Izu, and he actually is the governor of Uraga. So he's the governor of this little tiny town. It's like being the mayor of Margate or something. That's what he is. But the government in Edo, none of those big, powerful guys want to have anything to do with it. It's not going to be good for them to come into contact with the Americans. So they say to Toda, OK, we will say you are the Prince of Izu. Is that OK? And Toda thinks this is hilarious. Sure, I'm the Prince of Izu, whatever. Izu is like... So that's like progressing from being, you know, the mayor of Margate to being sort of Prince of East Anglia or something.
Prince of Wales.
Prince of Wales, maybe.
Let's do that one for Donald Trump.
Prince of Wales. Prince of Wales. So, yeah. So Toda, you know, struts along looking very grand. We haven't come to Toda's moment of glory yet, but Kayama goes down and says, we have the man, we have the Prince of Izu. He is of incredibly high rank, as high as Commodore Perry. And the Americans say, oh, fantastic. Right, we'll hand the letter over. And then they say, oh, well, to celebrate that we've now sorted all this out, why don't you have a look around? So they take Kayama and his, some friends of his go on board. They have a look at, they'd have a look at the guns. There's a Peihan gun, which is a French, mammoth French cannon, which has been pointing straight at Uraga all the time. So they have a good look at that. And they look pretty hard.
Yeah, I bet they do.
They look hard. They look hard at the guns. They also see a daguerreotype. Some people in Japan already had daguerreotype cameras, but not the guys in Edo. So this is the first time for them to see
this is,
any kind
of
photograph. Just
to clarify, daguerreotypes are the early photographic process.
The first silver prints.
The mirror of a memory, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, the mirror of a memory. And the Americans then show him a globe, and the Americans are kind of nudging each other. Ha ha, you know, he's going to be really surprised. He doesn't even know the Earth is round. He won't know what this is. And Kayama goes, so what's the big deal? I mean, OK, this is a globe, this is where you're from, right? This is New York, right? This is Washington, OK? Now, down here in Panama, I gather you're building a railway. How's it doing? In fact, the Panama Railway was completed in 1855. And he then asked about things like the ship's engines. He said, so are they like railway engines? Japan, of course, Japanese didn't have a railway, but they knew. So the Americans were said to each other, wow. You know, we were pretty impressed, somebody wrote, with the extent of his scientific and geographic knowledge.
So really what we've got here, I suppose, is a bit of a seesaw in a narrative. Because when, as you described the Friday and these ships that come in, there's greater impressive spectacle that we've imagined. And then you've got a real tilt in the understanding. Because I suppose the idea that the Japanese would be ignorant and awed and ready to give in to whatever demand, but then they find that there's an awful amount of knowledge and intelligence in this place, which is disarming for them. So the power in a way has shifted from one side to another in a very subtle way. But I suppose one of the things that would be attractive about being there at this scene at this time is that there's a kind of slight comic air to it, isn't it?
Well, I would very much have liked to have been there. It would have been amazing. Each side describes it in terms of their own people. So if you read, for example, there was a journalist called Bayard Taylor who was on board. He never got off, but he was on board, and he writes about, you know, our men marching around in their uniforms and how impressive they were. And then he describes one of the Japanese as kind of looking like a kind of rather splendid knave of hearts, he thinks, or, you know, jack of hearts. The way that they see each other through each other's eyes is very extraordinary. But it's also, there is a kind of balance of power that the Japanese are able to fool the Americans quite a bit. The Americans never realised. They never did. It's only like later scholars who can do things like read the Japanese people's diaries.
Yeah.
Like Kayama had a diary. So it wasn't just the Americans keeping records.
Yeah, so whenever you read these early encounter archives or documents, they are delicately about power, aren't they? And about people saying the right thing at the right time, playing their cards either close to their chest or whatnot. So it seems that there's always a danger as well that they can progress to violence very quickly. So by this point, it's probably seen as quite a successful beginning for Perry, because he's arrived, he's been greeted, and there's a dialogue.
Perry is wary all the time. They're always very, very wary of attack. And my third moment, we're going to come to that.
Because
my
we'll come third... to it. Let's go to your third one, because it's on the Wednesday.
So
we've gone from the Monday.
Yeah.
So let's go then to our third scene. It's on the Thursday, the 14th of July. Edo Bay again. all within the span of a week. And we've had the arrival, we've had the meeting. What have we progressed to now?
So finally, the moment has come when Perry is going to hand over his letters. He's going to emerge from his glorious seclusion into the full light of day, be seen by the Japanese. As I said, the Americans have been wary and continue to be wary. So the first question had been, where will this meeting take place? The Americans say it has to be somewhere where our ships can get close to the beach. So they take their ships close to the beach at Kurihama, which is very near Uruga, and they train all their guns on the beach. And in the morning, 50 or a whole bunch of American small boats leave the big ships and go onto the beach. All through the night, the Japanese have been building these splendid pavilions. So all through the night, the Americans are drawn up in their massive boats very near the beach. And there's this racket coming on from the beach. There's this bang, bang, bang of the carpenters kind of building these pavilions all night long. So there's bang, 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 bang. Finally, dawn comes as these splendid pavilions on the beach or just on the land, just off the beach. Lots of native Japanese people, lots of ordinary Japanese people have gathered to have a jolly good look at the Americans. The Americans come off the ship in small boats. And finally, there is a gun salute from the ship's 13 cannons, which is incredibly loud. I don't know if you've ever heard a cannon being fired, but it is really, really, really loud. So, you know, Japanese jump out of their skin. And Commodore Perry finally comes out and goes down and gets into one of the small launches, dressed in all his finery. And with him...
And this is his first appearance, is that
right?
This is
his first appearance, yeah. Yes. And there are lines of American soldiers on each side so he can walk, process up between the lines of American soldiers. To each side of him is a huge black steward. And they are, he wrote, the finest looking men of their colour that we could find in the squadron. So they're really big. And no Japanese have ever seen a massive black guy before. So there's these two big black guys, and then there's Perry in the middle. And behind, there are some cabin boys carrying rosewood boxes with the letters inside, wrapped in red velvet. And they walk up between these lines of American servicemen or sailors or whatever to the pavilions, which are on a hill. And there, seated there, looking terribly, terribly grand, is Toda, the supposed Prince of Izu, who's actually rather smug because he had only been the miserable, as I said, the mayor of Margate.
This is the mayor of Margate, elevated up
to Prince of Wales.
Wales.
Yeah, yes, exactly. Yes. So he's sitting there. There's a picture of him drawn by one of the American artists, looking very solemn, very grand. And there's always two of everything in Japan. So he has his counterpart, who is in Edo, who's the other mayor of Margate, is also now a second Prince of Wales, and they're sitting side by side. And the deal has been that they will not say anything. So that's lucky for them, because they probably wouldn't know what on earth to say. So they just sit there looking terribly grand in this pavilion. And then Perry comes in and the letters come out, and there's various interpreters, there's interpreting going back and forth. All the interpreting goes English to Dutch, Dutch to Japanese. So you can imagine the possibility of mistakes.
Oh, God, it's just so richly set for comedy, this whole scene. But at the same time, completely intriguing. And there's a lot of mistrust, obviously, on both sides as well. Just let's linger on Perry for a minute, because we've not spoken much about him so far. He's just popped out of his ship and he's been rowed ashore, and he's now playing this role, which is, I mean, it's unique almost, that he's one of the first Westerners to walk into this arena, isn't he? As a important figure, anyway, of significance, and to be greeted.
He is one of the first Westerners ever to set foot on Japanese shores, apart from 20 Dutch merchants. Mm. They were the only ones.
But that was in Nagasaki, so this is a different part of the country, isn't it? So are there any depictions of him, any photographs of him?
Oh, tons, yes.
What does he look like? Is he a...
He was known as Old Bruin, and he was pretty tough and rather feared. And he looks kind of... He's got a kind of hook nose. There's a picture of him in the Illustrated London News, for example. There's also photographs of him. He looks like he's about, I think, mid-50s. He's a man who takes himself very seriously. And apparently he didn't put up with any nonsense on shipboard, so you had to be very careful.
This is a really important moment in the history of Japan, really.
This is a completely crucial moment in the history of Japan. It had many, many repercussions which I could tell you about if you wanted.
Yeah, please do.
So basically, Japan was already divided, as I said, between those that thought that it would be better to open to the West and those that thought you shouldn't. The 260 princedoms were ruled by princes, a lot of whom were really fed up with being under the thumb of the shogun, so that the princes were divided into camps, those who were on the shogun's side and those who were not. The coming of Perry made the weakness of the shogun's government very apparent.
Right.
That they'd had to give in to him. And the next thing they had to do, the thing that Perry said was, when he arrived in his tent, he said, "Here are the letters. I will come back next April for an answer, and I will come back with a much, much larger force," which was a threat. So all in all, they stayed 10 days. They also sent survey boats up the river towards Edo and a massive steamship while they were at it. So they were very threatening in their behaviour. And after they had gone, one of the questions that the shogunate had to ask all those 260 princes was, "What shall we do?" And the shogunate had never before consulted the daimyo princes, never. They had always commanded them. But they had to ask them, because if they needed to get troops, they would have to get them from all those princes. So they had to ask them. And that was a fatal weakness. The result was, in the civil war, and then the next thing that happened after that civil war was the overthrow of the shogunate.
Yeah.
And the emperor was probably assassinated, and his son became the Emperor Meiji. He was only 14, very malleable age, and in 1868 he came down to Edo, which was renamed Tokyo. Tokyo, the word Tokyo means Eastern capital.
Right, so what we've got here is all these things Constantinering out from the arrival of these ships, really. And if we think about those scenes, what you've given us is a three-act story, isn't it, really? You've got the arrival, you've got the moment of contact, and then you've got this great ceremonial event at the end. So if we want to linger, if we want to stand by in the pavilion for a moment to see the mayor of Margate in as we can keep calling him, meeting Commodore Perry. This was a meeting that went well.
So Perry said something like, Here are the letters from the President of the United States to your Emperor, and here is also a letter from me." And there were two letters, the one from President Millard Fillmore saying that, "Could you please open your ports, certain ports, to American whaling ships?" They fairly stayed apart. But from time to time, American whalers had actually been shipwrecked. There were quite a few people who were recorded as having been shipwrecked, usually in Hokkaido, which is where there were lots of fish. And they would get scooped up and sent down to prison in Nagasaki and sent home pretty quickly. So the other part of President Millard Fillmore's request was, "Please treat you American castaways well." And then there was another thing from Perry. Perry's own commission was to open Japan to trade and amity.
Okay.
So that was the content of the letters. Perry said, "Here are the letters. This is what they say." And then there was a bit of a silence, I think. And everyone was standing around scratching their heads, thinking, what do we say now? Got to say something. And Perry then said, "Right, I'm coming back for an answer to the requests made in these letters, and I'm coming back next April with a much bigger force, because the ships you see here are just a very small part of the force." And that was pretty much it. It lasted about half an hour.
Okay. Edo, you said right at the beginning of this recording, you said it was perhaps the biggest city on the planet at that time, which is a wonderful thought, which hadn't struck me, because we're always so conditioned to think of London being the world's capital in the 19th century. Could you just maybe give a little description of what it would have been like at that time in history? I'm sure there's wonderful representations of it, but just paint the picture for the listeners, please.
It was the Venice of the East. Europeans that got there in those early days said it was the most beautiful place they'd ever seen. It was full of canals. There was no wheeled transport except for goods. People either went by canal, or they went on foot, or they went by palanquin. It was full of quite low wooden houses, and then in the middle was the shogun's palace, which was this kind of enormous moated area with many, many buildings. There were rings of moats around the outside. So there was a lot of water, a lot of willow trees. There was the high city, which was around the shogun's palace, which was where 260 princes had palaces. All those 260 princes were constrained to travel up from their domain every other year and pay homage to the shogun. If you were a very rich prince, you had three palaces. You had an upper, a middle, and a lower palace in Edo. These were glorious palaces, all with beautiful lacquerware, with lots of gold, And then to the east, there was the low city where the merchants lived, which was like a rabbit warren of lots and lots of streets, each with a small harem or bigger harem, depending on what kind of a bloke you were. And they also had laws prohibiting them, because they were low class, from wearing fancy robes. So what they did was they wore rather drab robes with like a gold lining, so that you could just toss it open for a moment and everyone would know what a rich bloke you were. Okay. So that was the low city.
I think it was really fascinating. So let's take a step back a moment, because I think you've given us three really, really vivid scenes which brought together tell a story of an encounter, but one which was to have massive consequences. So would you go so far to say this was almost drawing a line in Japanese history between the years of the Shogun and maybe a new imperial future that they were to embark upon?
I think the arrival of Perry was the most momentous event in Japanese history, without a shadow of a doubt. But it was the 15 years between Perry's arrival in 1853, the Meiji Restoration of 1868, that marked a complete transformation of Japan. I wouldn't call it imperial afterwards. It was ruled by an oligarchy. There was some sort of bureaucratic rule, but there was definitely a huge change. And Japan, after the Meiji Restoration of 1868, began to modernise with far greater speed than any country in the world ever has done, and became an industrial modern power, able to defeat China in 1895 and to defeat Russia in 1905. And as a Japanese diplomat said in 1905, "You treated us like barbarians, even though we sent you our glorious treasures, until we shot down Russians with quick firing guns, and it's only now that you acknowledge that we might be civilised."
Well, there we go. It's a country which obviously continues to fascinate you. And to me, it's got its allure and its enigma. And it's wonderful to talk about this moment in its history. One thing that we do at the end of these little recordings is to ask a question of our guests. Now, I want to say, if you could bring one tangible memento back from 1853 and this week in July to have in your office, maybe at home, is there anything in particular you'd like to bring with you?
What I would really love would be Kayama's glorious robe with gold and silver embroidery with the decoration of peacock feathers.
Well, thank you very much, Leslie Downer. I know you write about this period, the 15 years that you described, bookended by Perry's arrival here in the Restoration of 1868, in your quartet of novels, which are a wonderful way of exploring the history from a fictional perspective. And I'd recommend people to go and have a look at those. But for me, and for now, I want to say thank you very much for coming on this podcast, and I hope you enjoyed it.
Thank you, Peter.
Well, that was me talking to Leslie Downer about the Perry Expedition of 1853 just the other day. It's a fascinating era of history. And if you feel like you'd like to spend a bit more time in mid-19th century Japan, a bit more time with Leslie indeed, you can, of course, buy her Shogun quartet of novels that I mentioned right at the beginning, which take you through the whole 15 years of turbulence in the middle of the century in Japan. If you'd like to find out more about this time from History Today, then of course you can explore the additional content that's on the History Today website. There you'll find articles written by experts over the past 60 years from their archive. We're going to be back in a fortnight's time with another episode. That's with Professor Mary Fulbrook, who's just won the Wolfson History Prize, one of the most important and prestigious prizes in Britain, for her book about the Holocaust. We'll be talking about that next time, but that's it. Thank you very much for listening.